Wake you up, nothing will. I don't know what the hell they said, but it must have been pretty good. That was from who was that from? I've had that in my files for a long time. That is Auftrag Deutsches Reich, and the word before that, Stahlgewitter. And the song is called Bitter. There you go. You got the whole nine yards now. And this is White Aryan Resistance. White Aryan Resistance right here in the bunker on a very rainy, rainy day. It's been raining all night and looks like it's going to rain all day. How about that? Terrible Tommy here, and we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. Shut up. Boy, I get these electronic alerts about all kinds of stuff, and I need to take the audio off because it interferes with my work, man. Okay. And like I said, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, or if you want to write me at 1134 South Ferguson Road, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Going to be people out there who say, my God, he put his home address on there. All those creeps are going to come and get him. Well, you just come on down here, boy. Try to put your foot in my door. And my double-barreled sawed-off shotgun will blow your foot off. Oh, you think you're so damn tough. Well, I sent you out a couple of items this morning. One on the threat of Pakistan. With the nukes, they got all kinds of nukes over in Pakistan. Of course, you know how they got them. It had to come from the United States or somebody working for the United States. They said that this one doctor had stolen the plans and went back to Afghanistan and built these weapons. I think he had help from the United States. And, you know, they always want to, this is the old English Empire tactic of keeping two guys equally strong to neutralize each other. So they got India, didn't want India to get too strong, so they built up Pakistan. Now they don't want Pakistan to get built up too high and too mighty. But the trouble is, both those countries are full of nutcases, and they got nukes. And they got nukes. And here's old Bomsky. He's going to a big meeting today. 15 countries leaders going to meet there. Well, I noticed one thing. Russia's not meeting with them, and I don't blame Russia for that. Yeah, they're going to meet, and they're going to talk about, well, what are we going to do about these nukes? What the hell are we going to do about these nukes? Wait a minute. We started the whole nuke thing, man. We've been building them, and he's already planning to update the nuclear program in this country and build more nukes, but yet he's going to go over there and tell everybody else how they shouldn't have nukes. I can't understand why you don't want Iran to have nukes, but you want Pakistan, it's okay to have nukes, and India. Well, they're crazier than bedbugs over there, man. I think I'd rather have Iran with nukes in those countries. And the other program I'm going to send you out is on the economy and on the banking. I'll send these out as add-ons because I don't want to take all the time up on the radio show. So, and also they'll be up on our website, resist.com, under either one will be under banking or economy, and the other will be under crazy assholes with nukes. Yeah, right. Hey, we had a good time on the radio yesterday with Andrew Carrington. Hitchcock. Yeah, that's a long moniker. Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. Yeah. I wonder if he's related to Wild Bill. How about that, you know? Well, we're going to do a little cooperation, see how it works here. Now, next Wednesday, we're going to cut another show. And I want him to be, I'm going to ask him to report on the Dover deal. I think it's this Saturday that the right and the left are going to go down and roll in the gutter at Dover. Yeah, and the cops, too. Well, I just want to see whether any of those people over there are doing better than we are here, because the right wing over here likes to roll around in the gutter, too. But what I want him to do is try to tell some of these right and left wingers, let's go up and roll around in the gutter with the city of London, the banks, the big banks. Quit squabbling with each other, if at all possible, and go after the system, the ruling class, the city of London. And then you get you accomplish something there, you know. So I hope we get some reports back on what's going to happen or what happened this weekend. And hopefully that a lot of these racialists who happen to be right-wingers, a lot of them, don't fall into the trap of just rolling around in the gutter with these race-mixing lefties. You got to learn how tactics, learn how to beat them, learn how to get them when the cops aren't looking. Because even if you win against them in the gutter, the cops will wade in on you and beat your brains out and throw you in jail. You got to have better tactics than that, my British friends. One of the best tactics is to recruit a lot of these young lefties, because a lot of them are intelligent people. And I know they are over here. And if you can recruit them, and you agree on a whole bunch of things, or at least I do, but they don't agree on the race issue, and they're not going to go for this Adolf Hitler stuff. That's in the past. Forget it. Move on, man. Just say, let's meet in the middle and say that Strasser boy, Otto and Gregor Strasser, were pretty good guys. They weren't perfect either, don't get me wrong. But you wouldn't have had a world war if the Strassers would have been in charge in Germany. I can guarantee you that. Now, war does some interesting outreach to the public. We do that all the time. And in the last couple of days, we set up a debate between Ronald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Yeah, we had a little hall over here and brought them in. We had some contributors buy their tickets, so I'm going to play you back what happened here. A little bit, just a little bit.
I guarantee you. I will make a lot more ghosts. There's going to be so many ghosts. Now, a lot of people, there seems to be a growing trend. A lot of people are very upset. Most ghosts, as depicted in film and television, always tend to be white. Senator Sanders, would you like to comment on this?
Sure. Look, I understand that I am what is known as a white male, and I'm on Tumblr, so I know that's wrong. I have educated myself through a number of enlightening reblogs, and let me say this. In my administration, I think the ghost will be diverse, just like my cabinet, like everybody around me. And the ghosts in a Sanders administration will be multicolored like the ghosts in a Pac-Man game.
Ah, thank you. Mr. Trump, we just have a little bit of time left in this part of the debate. Any comments on ghost diversity?
First off, I'll say something very, very important about ghosts, okay? They wear white sheets. They wear white sheets. We don't know what's underneath them. We don't know what's underneath them. Much like a great company that supports me, an incredible energy company that supports me called Triple K. Incredible energy. There's this British guy. He's a duke. His name is David. And he tells me about this incredible new alternate energy called white power. Unbelievable. And apparently, white power has been running this country for 350 years. I have no idea. All
I wasn't trying to get your attention, Chris. I just always hear music, and sometimes I like to play along.
All right, excellent. That brings us to the end of last week, Chris. No points for Mr. Trump's answer. That brings us to the end of Rapid Refresh Presidential Debate Edition. We are going to decide once and for all who will end up in the White House by the end of the show. We're going to be holding a special presidential hashtag war later on. We're going to continue our At Midnight debate with Donald Trump and Senator Bernie Sanders when we return.
Well, that was part of a lot longer debate that we had, but we ran out of time there, so I took the what I thought was the most important parts out there about the power company, the Triple K Power Company that's supporting Donald Trump there, and the Duke out of England, Mr. Duke, that is helping support him too. How about that? I'll you pass that along there. Well, let's check in on the hate crime scene, man. They're all over the place. Police investigate Heritage Center vandalism as hate crime. Authorities in Kentucky are investigating a case of vandalism at a African-American Heritage Center as a hate crime. London City Police Captain Daryl Kilburn tells news outlets that some dirty bird spray-painted a sign outside the Laurel County African Nigger American Heritage Center in London with the letters KKK and the number 1488. Wow. Which is a code that references white supremacist slogans. Oh, I see. City police and FBI. And the FBI, man. You want to get a job? You can get a job with the FBI easy now because they're signing on. They're hiring like mad. They got to have FBI in every town. Yeah. They're investigating the vandalism as a hate crime. Well, goddamn. It's terrible, you know. Negroes just can't get a break anymore. Wayne Riley, the center CEO, says he first noticed the vandalism when he drove past the building. Police told him that he could cover the sign if he wanted to. Selena Riley, the center's assistant office manager, says she doesn't want the sign covered. She wants everybody to see that sign. Wow. Let's see here. Is there any more to this? Wayne Riley opened the center in 2004 at an abandoned church he grew up attending. Police urge anyone with information, wink, wink, to contact authorities. Wow. Terrible. Well, they want to get all over Trump again because he didn't say the right thing about abortion. The Republicans got to learn that one of the reasons why they're losing ground and have been losing ground for years is because they spent all their time yapping about abortion. Now, I don't like to see white babies aborted, but I'm telling you that it's going to happen. And if white women want to get it done, well, they're going to do it, and unless you get violent or something, there's nothing you can do about it. So forget that. Besides, we don't want abortion to be outlawed because more and more non-whites, Negroes especially, are getting abortions. Abortion's a big business in the ghetto. In the ghetto. So I'm all for abortion, you know. And, in fact, I'm going to put a sign out in front of my house today, abort Muslims, and see what happens. I'll probably get some whacked-out Christian throw a rock through my window or something. But anyhow, they got to learn that, you know, all kinds of people are calling into these right-wing radio shows, and a whole lot of them are saying, look, this is one reason I haven't stayed in the Republican Party, because you spend too much time on issues like that. And so if you're a religious fanatic, of course, it affects you. Of course, you don't give a shit about a late-term abortion of military men going over to seas and fighting in your capitalista wars. You don't care about that. The late-term abortions are going on all the time. And the white working men, they get shot in the street by the cops don't care about that, you know. So anyhow, Trump is not going to lose hardly any ground on that, because that issue is becoming a non-issue. People are going to do it are going to do it. People don't want to do it are not going to do it. So anyhow. And most of these Christian churches are all happy that we're having late-term abortions of leaders of other countries and people in other countries all over the Middle East. Late-term abortions are okay because they're not, most of them, or a lot of them, are not Christian. Oh, man, it's such a hypocritical society. Well, I see they got an eviction notice at the church of John Coltrane. Remember him? The jazz player, home of sacred jazz. Well, gentrification drives out the San Francisco church that treated his music like a prayer for social justice. There you go.
For a small segment of parents and kids who opt out of traditional public schooling, something is changing. Non-religious families often find it difficult to educate their children without relying on conservative Christian curricula and communities. Aiden Smith, 14, and his mother Laura look over his English homework in their Long Beach, California, home. Jenna Scheinfeld. The modern homeschooling movement is one of revolt. From its humble beginnings in the 70s, led by graduates of the hippie generation who saw public schools as too constrained and religious, to its pop cultural peak in the 80s and 90s under conservative Christians who wanted more God and less evolution in the classroom, homeschoolers and their parents have pushed aggressively against mainstream education. Today, there are more than 1.7 million homeschooled kids in the United States, roughly double the number of those at the turn of 21st century. Religious families, nearly exclusively Christians, make up more than two-thirds of them, and religious curricula and social groups dominate the community. In states where homeschoolers are required to be part of a larger umbrella school to meet government learning standards, those networks are frequently organized by churches. For a small segment of parents and kids who opt out of traditional public schooling, something is changing. They are also opting out of religion. Studies suggest that young Americans are more likely than their older peers not to identify with any religion. While about 1 in 5 of all Americans aren't affiliated with a religious group, the same is true of roughly 1 in 3 people in their 20s and 30s. And while atheists and agnostics account for just a sliver of the country's population, more than two-thirds of them are under 50. The number of those under May 18th also be growing. In recent years, advocacy groups have successfully launched a handful of secular clubs in high schools across the country. For some of today's kids, being non-religious isn't special, it's normal. More and more people want to teach their particular set of values and beliefs in schools and not have the state do it, said Brian DeRay, the president of the Salem, Oregon-based National Home Education Research Institute, who has studied homeschooling for 3 decades. As the number of atheists, agnostics, and secular people grow, there are more of them homeschooling, too. Aiden Smith jumps on a trampoline at his house in Long Beach, California. Jenna Scheinfeld. I never intended to homeschool. I'm an accidental homeschooler, you could say, said Laura Smith, 49, who has homeschooled her 14-year-old son Aiden since August. Her elder son attends public high school in their California city, Long Beach, where the family lives in a modest suburban home about 20 minutes from the ocean. Then I got this kid. The school system was sucking the life out of him. He had ADHD and dysgraphia, a disorder that makes it difficult for him to express himself in handwriting. A special education teacher, who Smith described as emotionally abusive, didn't seem to her to be interested in helping him improve. There are a lot of hurdles to success in homeschooling, meeting state guidelines, making sure your child gets a high school degree, helping your child compete for college admissions, and more. Non-religious families face an additional challenge: finding lesson plans, qualified teachers, and daytime social groups that aren't overtly religious. Parents often decide what kind of religious or non-religious education their kids will get, and the kids either follow suit or rebel. In Aiden's case, things happened differently. "I didn't ever believe in God," said Aiden, who started calling himself an atheist after learning the word from a segment on The Daily Show when he was in sixth grade. "Religion just makes no sense." When Smith decided to homeschool her son and started searching online for resources, she realized most homeschool families are Christian. Eventually, she started following secular homeschooling message boards and Facebook groups to figure out which lesson plans are atheist-friendly and which science books and instructors will teach evolution. Finding non-religious resources has been difficult at times. You can't even buy a planner sometimes without there being Bible verses on it, she said. You can't even buy a planner sometimes without there being Bible verses on it. Each day, Aiden wakes up around 10 a.m., ready to sit at the dining table or his desk and start on a mildly plotted schedule of math, science, social studies, English, and P.E. He uses a computer to bypass his handwriting problems, and he and his mom have come up with creative interpretations of traditional subjects that get him more excited to learn. For English, he's writing a review of the film Aliens, and last month, his writing project was an essay arguing against the death penalty. For science, he's creating a comic book based on Batman, in which the Joker and Scarecrow sell poisons on the black market. For PE, he takes figure skating lessons on the weekends. He's currently working on his single axle jump and recently auditioned to play a pirate in a Peter Pan kids' ice show. Every 20 days, Smith turns in Aiden's work to a learning specialist from Excel, the charter school he's enrolled in as a homeschooler, and she regularly writes summaries of his lessons for state audits. In California, enrolling in a charter is one way many homeschooling parents get public funding to support their kids' educational needs. For Aiden, this includes speech classes and occupational therapy to help with his handwriting, along with the homeschooler's art class and science labs he attends. Religion often comes up in his home-based classroom. His first essay as a homeschooler over the summer was about Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who wouldn't issue marriage licenses to gay couples. Here's what he wrote, in its original form. "Recently in the news there's a clerk not making marriage license for any couple. The First Amendment works with and against the clerk. Some parts of the First Amendment include freedom of press, assembly, and religion. The whole reason we know this is because of the press. The county clerk couldn't tell the press to leave because it goes against this amendment. Now the whole world knows about this crazy county clerk. People think it means you can discriminate because of your religion, but it's actually the opposite. I just don't think religion is real. The first thing is that a snake talked," Aiden said, recalling the story of Adam and Eve. "After I heard that, I completely gave up on it." Aiden Smith's geometry homework, Jenna Scheinfeld. Talking to secular homeschoolers, one theme comes up repeatedly: Each family and child is different and went into homeschooling for different reasons. Some Christian parents seek out secular homeschooling forms and curricula for their kids not because they are against religion, but because they don't think religion belongs in education. Others live the Bible Belt and sought out homeschooling to completely remove religion from their kids' upbringing. Still others decide to homeschool because their kids have learning disabilities and weren't performing well in public school for them. Finding a secular form of education isn't a priority. Many atheist, agnostic, and non-religious kids and parents credit social media with helping them realize there are others like them. In nearly every place in the United States where there are homeschoolers, there are organized park days where kids get together weekly to play with other kids, go on field trips, or participate in sports. The California Homeschool Network, an extensive but incomplete compendium of resources in the state, lists 47 Christian homeschool support and park day groups, and 7 that are secular. But across the state and country, there are dozens, perhaps hundreds, of secular homeschool Facebook groups where moms and dads post photos, hatch ideas for social gatherings, and discuss their struggles and successes with state laws. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Laura Corbell has homeschooled her daughters, a seventh grader and a fifth grader, for 2 years. She left her job as a merchandiser for Hallmark to teach her kids because her younger daughter was performing poorly in public school. The family doesn't attend church, although they celebrate a secular version of Christmas and Easter. The kids like the gifts and Easter baskets, Corbell said, but we had issues with lying about Santa. Corbell stopped attending church when she was 5 after she told her dad she didn't like it, and services are largely foreign to her girls. I was thinking I'd just plug these words into Google and get some resources, but every single thing I would delve into would have some religion in it. It was so frustrating, Corbell, 45, said of her first foray into homeschooling. It's not about being anti-religion. It's just that you want to teach kids your own belief system. I just wanted unbiased resources. Now, Corbell runs secularhomeschoolfamilies.com, where she vets hundreds of secular-friendly curricula and parenting guides and lists Facebook groups across the country for parents and kids to join. In the Chapel Hill, Durham, Raleigh area, she's part of a group with 900 members. It's not about being anti-religion. It's just that you want to teach kids your own belief system. From San Diego, Blair Lee runs Secular, Eclectic, Academic, Homeschoolers, a Facebook group of nearly 5,000 members across the country. She homeschools her 16-year-old son, who says he leans toward Buddhism and Baha'ism and has authored chemistry and biology lesson plans under a series called REAL Science Odyssey. For homeschoolers, sometimes we beat ourselves up about the differences between us: who is atheist, who is secular, who is religious but interested in teaching real science to their kids, she said. The truth is, our differences are our strength. There are those like Molly Yoshimoto, the 35-year-old mother of 7-year-old Jake, who she homeschools in Hesperia, California. Yoshimoto didn't grow up with religion and never embraced or rejected it. She wants her son to make his own choices. I don't want to indoctrinate my kid on whether religion is this way or that way. Being around religious people is not a big deal, I just don't want it to be the only thing, she said. According to the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, a Purcellville, Virginia-based Christian group that has frequently brought lawsuits against state and federal schooling authorities on behalf of homeschoolers. About 25% of homeschooling families are secular, while roughly two-thirds are Christian. That group of atheist, agnostic, and non-religious homeschoolers is bound to grow as more people identify as non-religious. It's hard to say exactly how many American kids identify as secular and how many of them are homeschooled, since surveys typically focus on adults over the age of 18. But while we don't have data on the religious experiences of adolescents directly, we have asked questions about the type and frequency of religious practices Americans participated in during childhood, said Dan Cox, the director of research at the Public Religion Research Institute, in an email. We've found that younger adults today are far less likely to have participated regularly in religious activities when they were growing up than previous generations. Aiden and Laura Smith sit outside their home in Long Beach, California. Jenna Scheinfeld. Sometimes, those non-religious kids even reshape their families. Smith, the mom in Long Beach, grew up in a secular Jewish home and sent her kids to the Jewish Community Center for preschool. When her sons both became atheists, she became one, too. I'm happier with atheist children. As time goes by, it makes more sense to me, she said. Still, there are little artifacts of faith in her family's house. A menorah sits next to a bookshelf in the living room, otherwise crowded with Aiden's figure skating trophies. Each year, the family celebrates Hanukkah to honor their Jewish cultural background. Aiden's dad and Smith's husband, Kemal, is a Turkish-born Shiite Muslim, yet like his wife, he isn't religious. The family also celebrates a holiday from his upbringing, Seker Bayramai, the festival after the fasting month of Ramadan that's more commonly known as Eid al-Fitr. The kids mostly like it because they get free candy, Smith said. While he was working on his Aliens review and comic book in March, Aiden talked with his mom about everything from spelling to politics. He's a Bernie Sanders fan, to Christianity. You know, there's one religion that makes no sense at all. I think it's called Mormon. I saw it in an episode of South Park, he said during a study break. You have to realize you have friends who are religious, his mom replied. I know, that's why I don't talk about it with them, Aiden said. The conversation veered into the delicate balance of raising an outspoken atheist teen in a world that's largely religious. The family recently found out the family next door is conservative and Christian after they put up a Ben Carson for President sign on their lawn. Aiden and his mom decided to stick to talking about pets with them, rather than politics or faith. Years ago, a former neighbor told Aiden about hell, and how gay people like his aunt end up there. Smith said these kinds of incidents make her fume, and have pushed her toward atheism. After years of this being shoved at him, things he doesn't even remember while in public school, sometimes I just want to shove it back, Smith said. As Aiden gets better at his English essays and dives deeper into social studies lessons, more of his schoolwork revolves around criticism of religion in one way or another. Jesus was a carpenter. He did some nice things, Aiden said during that recent study break at the dinner table. But he didn't actually create a religion. He was Jewish. And he celebrated Passover, if you believe the stories, his mom added. I believe historians, Aiden replied.
Well, that was a long one. I didn't know, realize it was that long when I put it in. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this article, and a lot of it's nonsense, but there's a lot of good stuff in here that young people are beginning to move away from religion. And that's good. Whether they'll move into something else that's equally bad, I don't know. But if you get them out of this Christ insanity thing, it's got to do some good. Because as long as we're saddled with Christ insanity, it's going to be worse. Because most of your race mixing and everything comes out of Christ insanity. At one time, the Christian churches were more racist, that's for sure, but not anymore. They're just the opposite. So anyhow, you can take from that whatever you feel is important to you. One thing I'd like to get through to these people is that, like where the kids said Jesus was a carpenter and he did nice things and he was Jewish, well, he didn't exist. And to keep perpetuating that myth is one of the cruelest things that's been perpetuated. Well, as I lay in my bed in the early morning hours, I heard an interesting refrain through the web radio. And they were talking about the Camp of the Saints, the book written published by Jean Raspail of France back in the 70s, which was a big hit among our type of people with our type of thinking. And we pushed it as much as we could, but it never really got the circulation that it needed. It's about the invasion of Europe by millions of non-whites. Let me read a couple of things here that were in the front of the book. My spirit turns more and more towards the West, toward the old heritage. There are perhaps some treasures to retrieve among its ruins. I don't know. And that was Lawrence Durrell. Also, as seen from the outside, the massive upheaval in Western society is approaching the limit beyond which it will become metastable and must collapse. That was Solzhenitsyn. Remember him? That was a lone wolf with a lot of guts, Solzhenitsyn. Allegory or prophecy is Raspail's apocalyptic vision, really the way the white world will end? Already a sensation in Europe, this brilliant and controversial novel is about the haves and the have-nots of the world. The mighty white nations confronted by the legions of the impoverished, starving, black and yellow peoples known as the Third World. The time is in the near future. In New York City, racial violence has become a way of life, and barricades have been erected around the black ghettos. In London, 800,000 Commonwealth nationals are demanding their full human rights. In Manila, a French cruise ship has been invaded and seized. Millions of Chinese are massed along the Russian border, and across the world, refugee fleets are forming. The attention of the Western world is focused on India, where a million men and women and children have boarded 100 dilapidated ships. It is the last chance armada, a pathetic convoy bound for paradise. A nonviolent crowd of survivors coming in the flesh to knock at long last at the gates of abundance. As news bulletins flash around the world, everything seems to indicate that the final destination will be France. What will be done? What are these people? Pitiful refugees or a pitiless enemy? Saint-like sufferers or an invading army? Awesome in its dramatic descriptions, written with passion and ironic eloquence, this compelling novel will infuriate some readers. Yet no one will forget it or remain unaffected by the questions it raises about the future of the world. Yep, that's it. Well, I'll read a few more pages here for the remaining part of the show. This is about halfway, two-thirds of the way through the book. And things are already out of hand in France. the mobs are in, the non-white mobs are roaming the streets and so forth. And meanwhile, the ships have made their journey from India and with their millions of non-whites, and they're about to embark on the beaches of France. Okay. One of them stood up behind the counter and declared, "A round for everybody on the house." These are non-whites. The example was followed in the neighboring bars, but only one did it threaten to cause trouble. The owner, not a man to be trifled with, grabbed the ever-ready pistol from the till, brandished it at the crowd, and submerged his bar like a great spring tide. At which point a hulking brute from Guadalupe, head of some student activist group or another, went swaggering up, hands on his sides, and stuck his chest squarely in front of the barrel. He apparently had a first-class memory and a talent for imitation, because standing there eye to eye with the owner, he proceeded quite simply to recite, and it was as if the president himself was speaking. Quote, "And so I am asked, every soldier and officer, every member of the police, asking them from the depths of my conscience and my soul to weigh this monstrous mission for themselves and to feel free either to accept or reject it. To kill is hard, even harder to know why. Myself, I think I know, but I don't have my finger on the trigger, and my gun isn't aimed point blank at some poor soul's flesh. My friends, whatever happens, may God help us or forgive us." Having said his say, he burst out laughing to his friends' applause. It was a curious moment, as hatred gave way to the subtler emotion, as if they were sorry to see the balance shift and to lose the antagonism long advantageous to blacks of their position. Rising above the uproar, a voice cried out, "Come on, boss, have one on us. And tomorrow, if you're a good boy, maybe we'll even pay for our drinks. Cheer up. We all got to live, don't we?" That was the blacks talking to the white bar owner. "Not at this price," the owner muttered, shrugging his shoulders, throwing down his gun. He pocketed the contents of the till. Then he walked out into the night, straight ahead, without looking back, as the crowd stepped aside and let him pass. A moment later, on the boulevard, he found himself forced into a doorway as a solid mass of non-white flesh came surging over the sidewalk, refusing to give an inch. The drudges of the depths had begun to swarm through Paris. At this point, a little-known event took place, one that historians, in their wisdom, prefer to pass over. Since many a feather would doubtless be ruffled in today's high government circles were it to be discussed. We speak of the frenzied flight of all the coat and tie blacks before the army of African squill men, sweepers, troglodytes, and menials. They were led by their witch doctors, needless to say, especially the chief, that hero of the dismal cellar, and the ragtag priest, apostle of the slums. Later, latter-day Cardinal Lavangiri himself, evangelist to the Africans, and do-gooder of note, ever since some of their number had begun sweeping gutters in whose wee small hours when their gentlemen brethren would pile into their cars, parked all day on the hallowed pavement, the myth of a black utopia had spread through their cellars and under the sheet metal roofs of their hovels. The tribal princes were the worst offenders. What on earth did they have in common with the poor nigger pushing his broom? Skin color? Come on. how maddening it was for these upper crust blacks, middle class blacks, Republican blacks, here in the heart of the Capitol, scene of their social successes, to find themselves on every sidewalk, by every sewer, behind every rubbish truck, face to face with their ragged doubles, cold and hungry, whose dark skin peddled so cheaply, offended that black pride of theirs that they valued so much. We should pity them. Really, that night they were caught in the midst of the truly unbearable web of hate, abhorrence for the whites, disgust and contempt for their gutter-dwelling brothers, and above all, that loathing for the working-class black who had tracked them all the way to France as they managed to escape the fate of the race in the white man's wake. Yes, the redemptive myth of the Ganges opened many a subtle rift. Nothing seemed clear anymore in those murky waters of impending doom, waters that the beast had blackened and designed like an octopus spewing its ink. Could that be one explanation? Be that as it may, as soon as the shabby, swarthy troops came trampling the pavement in front of the Café Odeon and other centers of the black utopia, the battalions of mannequins took to their heels like a pack of scared rabbits. Still, we have to admire their presence of mind. By daybreak, they had pulled off an amazing coup, saving their skins. Quite simply, they had made the rounds of the neighborhood. A good one, as everyone knows, ringing all the bells and saying something like this to each terrified bourgeois couple at the door. Monsieur, madame, we've come to help you. Since midnight, you can see the handwriting on the wall. No more of those special rights you've always enjoyed, or at least you're going to have to share them, first with the third worlders, workers, and later with anyone else who decides to join their cause. The streets are full. They've already taken over. Who knows, in a few minutes, whole families may show up at your door, and like it or not, you'll have to make room. They'll pitch camp in your parlor. Of course, we don't begrudge our poor, desperate brothers, the ones who break their backs working for you white folks, the ones you couldn't live without, but the rest of us, students, princes, professors, diplomats, intellectuals, artists, trainees, in this or that or nothing, take your pick. The rest of us are men of taste, steeped in your culture and your style, your way of life. Naturally, we want to preserve the elegance and refinement that we feel we owe so much. Clever argument that it usually got them. Now the best thing would be if we would move in here with you. Two or three of us niggers, that's all. Better to share with us thinking alike, the way we do, than to be invaded by a bunch of poor, ignorant beggar niggers who don't mean any harm. Heavens knows, but who just won't respect things? If you see what we mean, madam, monsieur, it's getting late. When the others come and ring your bell, you'll better be much better off if you see a black face or two at the door. Come, let us take care of it. You go hide and leave everything to us. They spoke so well and looked so neat, these middle-class blacks. Spotless shirt, plain dark tie, horn-rimmed glasses. That bourgeois couple, backs to the wall, could only agree. The least of two evils. These look all right, after all, and they're clean, and they smell nice. Better no good fancy Dan snob than a plain, dirty nigger. no matter how honest. A gentleman, at least, who won't touch my daughter. And so, with a simper, quote, let us show you around. We could fix you a place, maybe there on the sofa, a bed, you say. Of course, that's the least we can do. We have two bathrooms. It won't be any trouble. And besides, probably won't be for long. Then the death blow. Why, yes, madam, for good. Quite so good for so good. The rats won't give up the cheese called the West until they've devoured it in every last crumb. Big and thick as it is, that will take them some time. They're at it even now, but the cleverest of the rats save the best parts for themselves. Inevitable offshoot of any revolution. Yes, privileges there are born that historic night, and hailed at the time as avant-garde triumphs, but everyone ignores them, or pretends not to notice. And anyway, on the basic issues of the new regime, stands absolutely firm. Someone's, for example, came up recently with a plan for discrete exchanges in the living arrangements. Half an apartment accompanied by blacks, for half of another occupied by whites. No difference in the democratic use of the quarters, but only in their racial makeup. Certain whites who have managed to put aside some cash have been known to slip rather handsome bribes, sub rosa, of course, to their dark-skinned colleagues. It seems, in fact, that many such exchanges worked out in the recent past to everyone's satisfaction, buying off the middle-class niggers. But a stringent new law intended to ensure proper racial mix has just put an end to such relics of an age of long past. Perfectly logical. No point in abolishing the concept of race on a public level. Just turn around and restore it in the private. That wouldn't make sense now, would it? As we write these lines, we can't help but recall an old American law dating back to the 70s, forerunner of all the anti-racist legislation. The school busing law, it was called in those days, in the United States. The black and white races lived more or less apart, secluded from each other. That being the case, it was decided in the name of integration to transport a certain number of little white children to black schools, and vice versa, in equal proportion. How many tots traveled scores and scores of miles each day while others went the same route, exactly in reverse? Well, people protested in the name of useless fatigue, absurd expense, freedom of choice, in the name of everything you please but racism. Never racism. It was too late for that. Why, the very word was distasteful, so busing won out. And now they celebrate busing day in every school in the whole world over. In conclusion, a few words about the inevitable appearance that night of the idiots, simpletons, madmen, and maniacs, when everything in society suddenly stops functioning rationally. That's when the misfits crawl out of the woodwork, and with them their resentments, their utopian visions, their neuroses and their psychoses. Mad dogs on the loose, a merry-go-round of feeble minds, free at last of all the social fetters. Historians faced with mass of documents concerning that night, some of which revealed quite incredible details, came to the conclusion that society of that bygone era must have been oppressive to the utmost for its breakdown to unleash such a rash of psychic apparitions. Psychiatrists, by the way, exulted. They had long seen society as fostering mental decay and had gone so far as to turn the insane back on the streets, so as not to compound the oppression with another. Of course, that's what Ronald Reagan did, you know. he opened all the mental hospital doors and shoved them out on the streets. They've been there ever since. None of which, however, takes into account the vital role of the redemptive myth self-inflicted and sublimated, like drugs in the past. But let's go on. This isn't the time for academic debates. Let's settle for a few simple facts among thousands. Sex crimes, small and large, were rampant on that night of nights, from the indecent exposure to all the rest. Never had so many organs dangled from so many unzipped flies. While the normal people ran off or stayed in hiding, the public urinals, in Paris especially, and in all the big cities, had a sudden surge of traffic, the lights of which they hadn't been since the liberation in 44. It's no accident, clearly, that the two myths of similar nature should produce the same results. From setters to sadists was just one easy step. And so the same young lady who felt that she was being ogled and followed every day, a common enough symptom of the modern urban illness, was killed this time by some idiot sex-craved nigger slayer. Even today, years later, they still dig up bodies of women and children from old abandoned building sites, like those bombs from the past wars that surface in our cities every now and then. The same outburst spawned a flurry of accusations and denunciations, so many, in fact, that the authorities to this day haven't managed to sift through them all. And when the post office finally came back into something resembling normal, they were amazed at the number of anonymous letters slipped into the boxes that night. Of course, that wasn't really so unusual. In times of exceptional stress, humanity plumbs its most gangrenous depths. One novel element this time, though, the loads and loads of letters from children informing on Mommy and Daddy, if you please. Yet even there, no need for tears in China, after all. During the Cultural Revolution, the youngsters had done much the same, with great abandon, and heaven only knows how the West heaped praises on them for it. As for old customs revived, let's mention just one. Shaving the ladies' heads in revenge. Did such and such a secretary sleep with her boss, or this factory girl with her foreman? Next morning they found themselves bald as a Buddhist monk, not to mention other forms of Gaelic vendetta. Detestable one and all. Tires slashed, house fronts spattered, windows broken, dogs poisoned, pastures plowed up, trees sawed in two. Of course, none of this tells us anything new about the consummate baseness of the folk of the time. At least their third world confreres showed a more dignity and style in settling their scores. And lastly, under the simpleton heading, the droll case of 300 villagers living outside the Air France flight school at Deauville, Saint-Gatchin, invaded the airport at 3 in the morning to protest the name of their own jangled nerves, not a bit, led by the mayor in official regalia. The bumpkin band with pitchforks poised and flanked by their tousled females, black claws led to poundee, went storming the control tower in the name of the peace and tranquility of their cattle. Indeed, revolutions have been fought over less. Who knows where man's noble ideals may be lurking? The fact was that with so many jets thundering overhead, the cows had quite simply begun to waste away. Now in Normandy, if anything is sacred, it's the cow. The poor peasants had demonstrated time and time again, all to no avail, that their tempers were turned as sour as their animals' milk. And so no sooner had the President of the Republic let down his guard on the mayor's TV screen Then his honor stood up, tossed off a shot of Calvados, and announced, "This time, men, I think we've got them." Traditionalist that he was, he had the toison rung, and no one in the village doubted what it meant. The Ganges fleet was none of their business. And this Ganges fleet, of course, was these millions of third worlders that were on these old ships that were now landing on the French coast. "We don't worry about politics here. We don't meddle in other folks' affairs. Just sweep up in front of your own front door. But the airport now, that's something else. Ah, what a delightful concept of momentous, historic night." And that single tozen pealed loud and clear to save a bunch of stupid cows. Well, I guess that's about it for now. It might be a little bit hard to understand, but it's these just like it's happening today, third worlders coming ashore off these old ships, beginning their invasion of France, and there's still liberals involved that are trying to support it, even at that late date. That's what you'll have to deal with here. You'll have to confront those people, because to the last, they will be supporting the invasion and destruction of the West and the white race. And like the zombies wandering the streets, they'll need one slug in the forehead. That's it for now. I'll be back tomorrow, Freya's Day, She-Wolf Day. Yeah. In the meantime, have a nice day, and tick, 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 tick. In Jean Raspel's book, Camp of the Saints, these millions of people didn't have to come so far from India on old hundreds of rickety ships and transverse all the way around the South Africa and around the Horn and up and into the Mediterranean. They just come across from North Africa. I mean, much easier for them. Now, unfortunately, of course, you know what I've told you. Our military-industrial complex and bankers and predatory capitalists have created this mess. Now, it may have happened in the future at some time anyhow, but they have created this non-white invasion that will destroy Europe, and the United States is being destroyed already. And so will we have the guts to fight? Will the white Europeans, will the white Brits have the fight, have the fight in them to do what has to be done? Or will they say, "Oh, that guy coming down the street, he looks like us. He walks like us. But he's a goddamn zombie. Shoot him." No matter what caused these people to come into Europe, they have to be dealt with, and they have to be dealt with firmly. And finding the men and women who have the gall and the intelligence to understand that and meet them on the streets of Paris or wherever they're at and drive them out, we'll have to see.
Thank you. Razorback Sticky and Barbecue Chicken, Laundromat Bar and Grill. Well, I found old Bill sitting at the bar with a pistol and a change machine. He was throwing out quarters to a waitress named Star when I asked him if I could sing. Said, we don't like original material that's been done before. Well, I guess it's like a Sheffield train through the house and the place to be. A bank of Tennessee walls, Kentucky rain, and the one about the 33. Lee's guitar was like a chainsaw, that fit like a power drill. Get line, they kick. Raise the back, stick in barbecue chicken. Laundromat, bar, and grill. Well, in the 10 short minutes I was up on stage, watched the biker punch a cowboy's face. Perfect view, I was witness to the destruction of the whole damn place. Yeah, long as Sims, the white friend, he'll be